Where will I find my sense of ease and comfort? Will I run to the arms of my Creator? Hell no! I'm going to go shopping. I'm going to find me a man. I'm going to have some sexy poo. I'm going to eat. I'm going to get really busy watching lots of movies. I'm going to put off that inventory. I'm going to put off those amends. I'm going to, whatever. You know, I'm going to go rest in the arms of my Father. That's work, man. Don't say to me all the time, spiritual life is not easy. It is not for wimps. It is hard. And yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's hard telling the truth when I want to lie, especially if it's going to interfere with what I want. It's hard going to that meeting when I don't feel like it. It's hard saying yes when I want to say no. This really is about sacrifice. I don't want to go write that inventory. I really want to enjoy my resentment. You know? Because they're wrong. I really want to retaliate. I like to circle the wagons and retaliate. I don't want to be uncomfortable in my own skin. Let me get on the phone and call somebody. I don't want to sit here quietly in prayer. You know, I'm hurting right now. I think I'll go find a man. It doesn't occur, well, you're married, Val. Not a good idea to go scamming some strange, you know? But that's what I used to do. You know, we're comfort seekers by nature. I don't want to look at what's going on. I'd rather go find some strange, but I can't do that today. I pay a horrible price if I do that. It's not worth it. The suffering that I have gone through because that has been an option in the past is unbearable. The price is too high. I can't do that. So the things that I used to go to find ease and comfort sober that are not God are slowly being taken away. And that's a bitch of a place to be. Mary was talking about that a little bit last night. Stuck my last holdout on my cigarettes. Ooh, I got cigarettes still. Not giving those up. But, I mean, really, ultimately, it's just slowly and slowly being whittled away, my dependencies on anything other than my Creator. You know, and I get around my heroes in AA and realize just how far I still have to go. I used to say to Don, when am I going to get there? I just want to get there where everything's, you know, comfy, cozy, not too much conflict. My mind isn't making me crazy all the time. Just there, the spiritual nirvana. And he said to me, he goes, there is no there. You know, he keeps letting me down with the truth, you know? There is no there. So, you know, because I always wanted to get there, you know, a place where I'm just insulated from life. You know, and then I started to understand one of my favorite talks that he ever gave was in, it was either in Tennessee, I think it was in Kentucky. It was in Kentucky, I think in Lexington. But I heard him talking from the podium, and he was talking about, I don't understand what the hell he was saying. But he said, I am a spiritual being having a human experience. And ever since I woke up to that fact, I have been of the mindset, bring it on. Bring it all on. Bring on all the pain, the joy, the sorrow, the fun. Bring it on. Because I am a spiritual being having a human experience. I'm like, what does that mean? Huh? I don't get it. Now I understand what he's talking about. Or actually, I've just begun to understand what he's talking about. I don't even think I fully understand it, but I guess it'll show itself when it does. But I've started to understand what that means. So bring it on. You know, I'm just not afraid of life. I used to, you know, ignore my life. I don't want to pay attention to it because that involves responsibility. That involves caring about things. That involves me giving myself and not thinking about myself all the time. I got to pay attention. So got to have this psychic change. God has got to do it. I can't do it. I can't, you know, fix my marriage. I can't fix my relationships. I can't fix my relationship with my son. I don't know how to be a mother. I don't know how to be a wife. I don't know how to be a daughter. I don't know how to be a sister. I don't know how to be an effective AA sponsor. I don't know how to be an honest sponsee. You know, I like to lie to my sponsor because this is what I want you to think of me. Still caught up in that. I need your approval because you might fire me if you knew how sick I really am. You know what I mean? I got something to prove. I want you to think I'm okay. And they all know that you're not. Yeah, they all know. But, you know, we like to lie to ourselves. Our capacity, my capacity, for self-deception is just incredible. It's just incredible. I love this, the psychopaths, when they're talking about, they start to describe the types of drinkers. I'm like, that's me. I'm a psychopath and I'm proud, you know? That's like the badge of honor in AA, you're a psychopath. Which is kind of sad, but it's kind of pathetic to find, for being a psychopath, for that to be your badge of honor. And today what it means is a little bit different how it's been explained to me today, how they define psychopath and how it was defined back then, or different. But this is me. I'm absolutely emotional unstable. No doubt. Yeah, I'm emotionally unstable. And I'm always making decisions. I love this. Over remorseful, I make many resolutions, but never a decision. That is me to the T. I am a wimp. Jerry Elkins, he describes himself as a little weasel. I love that. I'm a weasel. I'm a pathetic little weasel. Conniver, manipulator, wimpy, wambly, wombly, you know? I'm a wimp. I make many resolutions, but I don't make a decision because that requires effort. That requires work. Spiritually lazy, emotionally and mentally lazy. I just want it given to me. Or, you know, I think I shared some of this last night, Don saying to me, quit trying to steal my experience. You're such a thief. Follow the directions. Have your own. You know, quit. Because I used to parrot this. You know, I was giving Don's talk when I talk. I'd give his talk. Not my own, his. And he's like, quit stealing my experience. Go have your own. You know, step out. Step out. Take some action here. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful for him because he helped me get a relationship with my Creator and start getting my dependence on my Creator because I wanted to put my dependence on him because I loved him so much and I wanted what he had. I wanted to be just like him. I wanted to be a little miniature Don, and which is crazy. It's crazy. There can never be another Don. But that's what I wanted. You know what I mean? I don't know how else to describe it like that. And my sponsorship before that was, you know, go here, do this, running my life. And I never really started to develop that relationship with my Creator, starting to trust that small voice within. And he really forced me to do that. He wouldn't let me worship him at all, which was kind of frustrating because I really wanted to. But he wouldn't let me do it. And I'm eternally grateful for that. You know, and they start to describe, you know, some of the different types of alcoholics. And a lot of times I see Big Book people get caught up in that's all there is. But it says this in many other types. So there's many other types of alcoholics. You know, and of course I love to hang on the manic depressive type who is perhaps the least understood by his friends and about whom a whole chapter could be written. That's me, because that makes me extra special. I'm the least understood. A whole other chapter could be written about what's wrong with me. You know, that kind of thing. That's me. But it says all these and many others have one symptom in common. They cannot start drinking without developing the phenomenon of craving. So it's not about my circumstances. It's not about my consequences, which is what I always use to define my alcoholism. It's what happens when I put alcohol into my body. Well, what happens is I have another drink. And then I have another drink. The idea of one or two is not even remotely appealing to me. Not at all. I like to be slap tore up, as a friend of mine said in Georgia. Slap tore up. They used to say, let's get slap tore up and go ham some hogs in a ditch. I'm like, what? Did you just say ham and hogs in a ditch? What? Ham and hogs in a ditch is what they were saying. So what you do is, down on the farm, is they got these ditches, you grease up in between your legs, they let the hog run through, and you try to catch him. That's him and a hog in a ditch. It's fun.
Especially when you're drunk.
Him and a hog in a ditch. They used to climb trees, have climbing the tree races and all that stuff. Anyway, I don't know what I was talking about. Oh, so the idea of having one drink isn't even appealing to me. I don't even understand that. I don't even get that. I really don't. I remember trying to get my mom drunk one time because she deserved it. I took her out for Mother's Day, and I liked to drink some champagne sometimes because, you know, sometimes it was a fun drunk because you're all giddy and bubbly and stuff. And most of the time I was a liquor drinker. I liked liquor. But champagne was fun every once in a while. It made me feel all girly on the inside. Anyway, so I'm taking my mom, and my mom's a girly girl. And, you know, it would be horrendous to her how I'm dressed today, that I don't have my hair did and the makeup on. She's a good Southern woman. You don't leave the house without that stuff in place. Anyway, so I'm taking her out on Mother's Day, and we ordered a bottle of champagne. No, I wanted to order a bottle. She didn't want a bottle. Oh, no, don't you want to? I'm buying. We can have a bottle. She goes, no, I'll have a glass of champagne. So she has her glass. I'm like, when she's about halfway done, I'm like, you ready for another one? You know, before it's done, let's get another one in place. We don't want to wait. She's like, no. I'm like, come on, Mom, do it. It's Mother's Day. Let loose. Have some fun. Did it feel good? I mean, because I love the drunk on champagne. But that doesn't happen to her. That is not the experience that she has. And we hear it talked about in AA all the time. They start to feel like they're losing control, and they don't like that feeling. They just don't like it. And I don't understand that. I really don't. And with my drinking, it's like I start to get one or two in my system. I'm starting to feel really good. Things are starting to make sense in my life. I'm ready to start making some decisions. That's right. I'm ready to start to go. The problem is I start drinking and I get to there and then I overshoot that mark. And I overshot it all the time. At one point I was keeping a journal because I wanted to start journaling when I got to there, so I would have the perfect recipe for there, and then I would just follow that recipe. And it just didn't work because I'd always overshoot, and then the journal became secondary, and I'd stop writing in my journal about the magic that I was writing down about what I was drinking or what I was taking. That was my favorite thing, was to try different combinations of stuff, because I'm going to find the thing that gets me there where I don't go crazy, where I don't get into trouble. I don't start, you know, making a mess. Because when you start making a mess, and people start getting on you about it, and then, you know, people are watching you. And it starts to become uncomfortable. And then you got to leave that situation or that group of friends, or you got to start going somewhere else to drink. I mean, it's a lot of work. I just want to get there and be okay and not create complete havoc so I can get there every day without all the consequences. And God knows if I could, that's where I'd be, probably. Anyway, so that's what happens to me. I developed this phenomenon of craving. And it differentiates me from normal drinkers and sets me apart as a distinct entity. I'm just different when it comes to alcohol. Something different happens to me when I put alcohol into my body that doesn't happen to non-alcoholics. And that's it. It's not complicated. That is it. But that's a nasty little condition that I got. It's a nasty, serious little disease, little problem that I got. And most chronic alcoholics are doomed. We are. We see in AA all the time. Most of us don't make it. Most of us die. And I don't mean to seem callous about that. I've seen so many pass drunk that don't stay. They don't stay. That's why it's so important we carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous and that we continue to help other alcoholics. I look around Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous has been around, 70 years? Mm-hmm. Most of the people that are in my home group and in meetings that I go to, most of them aren't 20 plus years, 30 plus years. They're the minority of an NAA. Most people that I see in AA today are between 1 and 7 years. Old timers should far outnumber newcomers, but they don't. Where'd they go? I know where they've gone. I see it happen all the time. Alcoholics. Step. We're still kind of running around with that. So you're talking about psychic change, got to have more than human power. Everything that I can bring to bear isn't enough to solve my problem, to solve my dilemma. I like what I used to hear. I got a mind that doesn't work and a body that won't die. It's a heck of a place to be. Another thing that really helped me get clear on my alcoholism was at the bottom of XXVII, whatever that is. And it's talking about that last sentence, they took a drink a day or so prior to the date, and then the phenomenon of craving at once became paramount to all other interests so that the important appointment was not met. I kind of went backwards, didn't I? But that's all right. And that helped me to define my alcoholism because there were plenty of times that I had commitments or I was supposed to be somewhere and I started drinking. And that absolutely became more important than being where I was supposed to be, doing what I was supposed to do. And that's throughout my drinking career, throughout my life. That's all I'm going to say about that. We talked about the different types of alcoholics. The chronic alcoholics are doomed. Not that we really care. Most of us want to die anyway. what do we do? It's like death doesn't scare us. Didn't scare me. It scared me a little bit sober in the sense that I'd woken up enough where I didn't want to die an ugly death anymore. And I knew that there was something different. So, you know, an alcoholic death was not appealing to me anymore because of just how we live before that happens. The stuff that follows that where he talks about it, Dr. Silkworth talks about his experience with a couple of alcoholics. I totally identify with that. The thing that really sticks out to me in a couple places there is over and over again they talk about he accepted the plan outlined in the book. He became sold on the ideas here. And the reality is if you're not convinced that you're an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, you're just not going to do this stuff. It's too much work. And unless you are desperate as desperate can be, why would you want to do this shit? You know what I'm saying? Why would you want to go to meetings, have it interrupt your life, start helping newcomers, start getting commitments where people expect you to show up, start having to go to work and be there on time and be a responsible member of society in the community, stay legal, you know? What's appealing about that? You know, it's so funny. I love alcoholics because we like danger. You know what I mean? It's like danger, danger, Will Robinson, danger. And we're like, yeah, what is it? You know, we're ready to report for duty. We like stuff that's dangerous. Like to live on the edge a lot. But do I admit that I'm hopeless? And do I accept the plan outlined in the book? And with pretty much without reservation. I mean, I'll bitch and whine and have done that, but do I accept the plan or do I have a better idea? As long as I have a better idea, I'm not going to do this. And my experience confirms that of going in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for 10 years, being in AA for 3.5 years, and I was not willing to do what you guys did. Not willing at all. I'd rather run around AA and just don't drink and go to meetings and go run and play. So I didn't want to change everything or have everything changed. That I didn't want that. I wasn't willing to pay that price because there's definitely a price to pay here. And they talk about, however, he did become sold on the ideas contained in this book. You know, am I sold on the ideas? Am I willing? So those were all questions, and because of the desperate place that I was in, I was like, absolutely, I'll do whatever you tell me to do. If I am working with somebody, you know, one of the questions that I ask them, if I'm convinced they're alcoholic, is, do you want to live? Because if you don't want to live, then I understand feeling that way, but do you want to live? And are you willing to go to any length to do this? And if they say, I think so, I'm like, they're not ready. Every person that I have worked with that says, I think I am, has not been willing to do this. Not one exception. And that's been my experience. The people that I ask, are you willing to do this? And they're like, absolutely. I'm terrified and I don't know what's going to happen, but yeah, I'm willing to do it. They've all done it. All of them. So I listen really carefully now to what people are saying. And Don used to tell me all the time, don't throw your pearls before swine, which is kind of a nasty saying, kind of, because it says swine. Yeah, and pearls and swine, whatever. So it's also a little JC for me. But, I mean, I love baby Jesus and all, but at the time it was a little, you know, biblical for me. But I understand what he's saying today. Don't waste your time. And our book talks about that too. If they don't want what you have, don't waste your time. Leave the door open, but move on. Go find somebody else that is willing to do what you do, that's willing to do this. Because they're out there, and their life depends upon it, just like my life depends upon it. That's why it's vitally important to me and my home group too that we're talking about a message of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I know that the alcoholic who walks in, their life depends upon them hearing a solid message. They may not be ready to hear it, but it's important that it's talked about. So Bill's story, I loved that, and I identified with it completely. And Camille had me go through the first 8 pages, and I was surprised that I identified as much as I did. But she had me go through the first 8 pages and, you know, wherever I identified with how Bill felt, thought, or drank. And there was a lot of it. I had ominous warnings that I failed to heed. I fancied myself a leader. I'm definitely one of those people that goes to work, and after like 2 days of being there, I know how to run that company better than anybody. and they might as well give them the boot, because I got plans and I got ideas. That got me fired at 12 years, by the way. That kind of arrogance. 12 years sober. Working a job that I loved, that I really loved to do, and I was not going to follow the rules. Not going to do it. Was not going to comply with conditions at work. Because I was going to do it my way, because my way is better. Look, I'm your top producing sales manager. Obviously, what I'm doing is better than what you've got in mind. I think y'all need to change your corporate philosophy and bring it over to my way of thinking, and everything will be fine. And I got fired for that. And rightfully so. Rightfully so. It was devastating, but it was great. It was a great experience for me. But I got leveled, which was what needed to happen. That's me. I absolutely fancy myself a leader. I'm going to rule the world. And this piece in here about, I think it's on the next page, about proving to the world, the drive for success was on. I proved to the world I was important. And that's me, just no power. No power whatsoever. But wanting to be somebody. And for a long time I thought, well, I think that's why I got involved in some of the industries that I got involved in. I worked with musicians in Atlanta and worked with artists, painters and sculptors and fine art photographers, because what I perceived with them was power because of their fame. So I'm going to steal that from them, and because that's what I wanted for myself. And I don't have that kind of stuff going on, so I'm going to steal it from you. I'm just going to get it from osmosis, from hanging around with you and running with you and playing with you. But that need to be important, to prove to the world I'm important. Money was everything to me. Everything. I defined everything by how much money I had or how much the money the man I was with had. And I have learned in sobriety by having nothing, by being stripped of everything, that I'm not my car, I'm not my job, I'm not my money, I'm not who I know, I'm not who my sponsor is. Because if I lose any of that, who am I? And when I lost it all, I didn't know. Because I did it several times. It took twice. Didn't learn it the first time. Had to lose it twice. So I know you can stay sober through anything. Because I have been in the position of no car, no job, no money, no place to live. All my stuff in little green garbage bags, living on people's sofas. It's a humbling experience. But I absolutely found my identity in all of those things. And that's how I defined myself, was by what I had. Because that's how I thought you were defining me too, because that's how I defined you. So I thought that's how you looked at me. I didn't care if you're an asshole. If you had a lot of money, I'm your friend. Really. So that kind of stuff. When you run around with this desire to be important and to prove to the world that you're important, that's what it looked like for me. It was real phony stuff, a huge phony. And there's just a ton of stuff in here. Though my drinking was not yet continuous to disturb my wife, my drinking wasn't continuous to disturb my family, disturb my husband, disturb my friends, my family members. Everybody was disturbed by my drinking at different points. And unrecovered, they're disturbed by how I live. When I was sober for that 3.5 years or dry, most people were disturbed by how I was living. I ran with the sick crowd in AA. I was an active thief. I also thought that prostitution was a good idea sober. And I was just doing stuff that I'd never done drunk. I'd run into stores. I love Nordstrom's because they had great customer service policy, and I took advantage of that fully. I'd go steal at one, drive 30 miles down the road, take it back, get cash back. Loved it. Sober. Sober as a judge, going to a meeting every day. with a sponsor and name only, my favorite kind. You know, because they don't get into your business and start directing you. My life can be disturbing, drunk or sober. What else is in here? I don't know. I just went through it. I identified with it totally. I found a tremendous amount of hope with the stuff that Bill Wilson talked about in regards to his recovery. I mean, just great directions, like on page 12, you know, talking about choose your own conception of God. It's only a matter of being willing to believe. That was key for me when I got to my really angry spot sober, when I was really angry at God, and I was being asked to set all that stuff aside and just be willing. Is it possible that I'm wrong? Am I just willing to believe that there might be a loving creator out there? And that that God wasn't doing this to me. But something really, like when they talk about the flimsy reed, that was me with God. It was a very flimsy reed to me. That belief, that faith, that understanding was very flimsy. But that nothing more was required of me, that I could start growing from that point. I used to think I had to have a lot of knowledge before I could start to trust and rely upon God. I went on a little intellectual pilgrimage and tried to get my hands on everything I could possibly read about the nature of God. And I mean, I was reading the Dalai Lama and Christian mysticism, metaphysical stuff. I even tried to delve into Plato. Now that was fun. That's way over my head. But just trying to find an answer. But again, when I look back on that, not that there's anything wrong with that, but I was trying to gain knowledge in order to control my creator. If I understand it, I can control it. And that's what I was trying to do. And what was behind that was just desperation for an answer. Just driven, just an internal desperate. And I guess that was a necessary part of my path. And what I found today is there's just nothing to know. Just show up and do what we do, and the rest will come. But just desperately wanting to understand and just wanting relief. So just simple stuff. And I love this. Thus was I convinced that God is concerned with us humans when we want him to enough. That kind of stuff used to piss me off. I'd read that when we want him enough. Well, if God's all loving and everything, why doesn't he just make it easy for me? You know, why can't he just poof me or something? You know, why can't he just remove all the doubt? Just let me know that God's there. I was famous for praying for signs. I need a sign. Praying for signs. And I mean, if the wind blew south, it was a sign. Having me out here, and I had a blast at the Taj Mahal last night at the Taj Mahal, which is Tom Amani's place, and got picked up this morning by the little roadrunner, Tony. Yeah, Tony Blankenship. He's the father. I'm the child. He's the director. I'm the agent. I did not like the nature of that relationship at all. I looked up the word discipline because it was in the 11th step. I got really hot about that one. Discipline means a systematic way to obtain obedience. I didn't like that at all. I mean, that just goes against my very nature. I just want to be a free spirit, you know? Don't oppress me, that kind of stuff. I'm oppressed. But I just didn't like the nature of that relationship. I wanted God's help, but I wanted God's help on my terms in a way that I understood and could control. And it just wasn't happening that way. And I love this. You know, there'd been a The real significance of my experience at the bottom of 12, the real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me for a brief moment. I needed and wanted God, and I've had those brief moments in my life. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came.
Oh, shit.
But soon, the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. And that's me, to a T. I got a lot of worldly clamors. Gotta be, gotta do, gotta get, gotta look good. Everybody needs to love me. I gotta make a lot of money. I gotta drive a nice car. My man's gotta be hot. I mean, whatever. I gotta be a good AA. Gotta be Miss AA. Worldly, those are all worldly clamors. All of them. I've got to be important. Got to be well respected. It's all worldly clamors. And they're going on a regular basis. And the only thing that quiets them down for me is prayer and being quiet and actively working with other drunks. It's the only thing. I mean, besides, you know, doing what I need to do to make sure my house is clean and my amends are made, is active work with other alcoholics and prayer and meditation. It's the only thing that removes that driving force within me. The bad vow. The evil vow. The dangerous vow. Which I like to let her come out and play sometimes, but then we have to tuck her away pretty quick. But sometimes it's fun. And I love the directions that are down here on 13. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. That's hard to do. Most of the time what I want to do is call somebody and have you fix me. I want to talk it out with somebody, and I want them to give me the magic mojo and make it better. And not that there's anything wrong with that. But when my sole reliance is on another human being all the time, then I'm never really sitting quietly and going to God and asking for that guidance and direction and then discussing it with somebody else. My response was always to go to you first. I used to, and how I started getting practice with that was I asked God to show me how to live that way. So what happened is I started... And that's, you know, if you start asking God to show you stuff, get ready, because it's coming. Was that I'd get into these binds, and I'd do my normal thing, which is start picking up the phone, looking for relief from another person, and nobody was there. Every person I called, voicemail, voicemail, voicemail. I was like, don't they know it's me calling? And, probably. I'm a delicate flower. Don't hurt my feelings. Really, probably. God probably told them. No, but it forced me to start going into prayer and sitting quietly and asking for direction, asking for guidance. So it's good stuff, but it has been hard for me to practice because I naturally want to go outside of myself for an answer, not go within for an answer. And sometimes it seems to me that I can get an instant answer, instant relief by going outside myself. It seems like sometimes the spiritual path is a little longer road. It's not, you know, instant relief. And I like instant relief. And I like the promises that are on the bottom of 13. My friend promised that when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, and that was good because the old one I had wasn't working. It was pretty negative, pretty angry, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems, and that was drilled into my head. All means all. No gray area. We submit everything to the circle and triangle. Everything. You got financial problems, circle and triangle. You got sex problems, circle and triangle. You got relationship problems, submit it. Everything gets submitted. Every area of my life. I don't get to pick and choose like I can hide from God. Like, I'm going to go hide behind the bush. He won't see me here, you know? But I didn't get to pick and choose which areas of my life I was going to surrender. It was absolutely throw it all out there. And throw it all out there. Belief in the power of God plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple. And this program is simple, although for a long time it seemed very complicated to me. Simple but not easy. Very, very true. Very true. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of light who presides over us all. You know, I used to tell Don, I'll never forget when I called Don, I told him that I was going to start working on my self-esteem issues. That didn't go over very well. He's like, what are you talking about? Did I do that right? Well, if it's not right, tough to. He said, this is about dying to self completely. We don't worry about self-esteem issue here. It's a non-issue. This is about entirely getting rid of self. You don't have to worry about self-esteem and building self-esteem. The goal here is to have no image of self whatsoever. Another way to put that to me is my insides match my outsides. Another way to put it, Elkins puts it this way, is becoming transparent. That's my goal, to become as transparent as possible before I leave this earth. God knows if that'll ever happen, but that's my goal. At the bottom of this 14, I love this because from the very beginning of the book, the thing that they talk about most, and it's all throughout the book, over and over and over and over again, they tell you, go help other drunks. Go help other drunks. Go help them. That's your job. You're awake, go help them. Don, you say all the time, my sobriety's not for me. It is for you. And I didn't understand that for a long time either. I just thought that was some nice spiritual thing that he said. Today I understand what he's talking about. A little more. I'm a little less self-centered. But it says, particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead. And that was the work. I used to say to Don, I'm getting ready to go through the work. He's like, what do you mean you're getting ready to go through the work? The work is helping other alcoholics. That's the work. The steps get you spiritually fit to go do the real work of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is helping another drunk. You know, don't sit in your house and workshops and navel gaze. Put legs on what you've learned. Go have an experience with what you've learned. I used to get so technical with the big book. He's like, you know, and I had all kinds of workbooks and all kinds of stuff and looking up every word and just getting anal retentive with him. He said, kid, you're missing the experience. You're getting so lost in the technicality of what the big book says that you're missing the experience. Go put this stuff into action. Put some legs on this stuff. See if it's really true. Go have an experience with these directions. Get out of your head. And which was great advice for me because that's what I had started to do. That's what I was doing. So faith without the work of helping other alcoholics is dead. It's gone, baby, gone, dead. And how appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive these certain trials and low spots ahead. They are going to happen. Life is going to come to visit. And that has been my experience. I've been carried through amazing, seemingly tragic things in sobriety. And the thing that has held me together is working with other alcoholics. When they say that working with drunks works when nothing else does, it is very true. I am at my best, my very best, when I'm sitting down one-on-one with another alcoholic, sharing our experience, strength, and hope. That is when I'm at my best, one-on-one. And they help me to toe the line. It's hard for me to talk out of both sides of my mouth. If I'm talking to you about living an honest life, it's kind of hard for me to maintain a dishonest one on the side. You got to start telling a whole lot of lies in order to do that. And then we get really spiritually, and I've done it, and got really spiritually sick again. Had to get honest, get humbled, all that stuff. If it weren't for the women I sponsor, I don't know. You know, when my sponsor died, before I even got home from work, they were all there. All of them were at my home. I couldn't do anything but just sit there, really. But they were there. And they didn't try to change me or make it better or anything else. They just sat with me and, they were just there. And they were there because they loved Dawn and they loved me and they knew how much I loved Dawn. And that's the fellowship. That's what they're talking about when this is something you must not miss. That's like really powerful stuff. That's what I've been looking for all my life within a group of people, to be a part of that kind of care and concern for other people. So working with others is paramount. And I love this. It's a design for living that works in rough going. I mean, they just say it over and over and over again at the bottom of 15 and that paragraph. We meet frequently. Why do we get together? I used to think that meetings were for me. I need a meeting. I got to go to a meeting. I didn't get nothing out of that meeting. That's the stuff that used to come out of my mouth. And then this was pointed out to me by lovely sponsorship. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. But that's why we get together, for the newcomer. So they can see that they're not alone, that there's a whole group of us that are crazy and on a path. They don't have to be crazy by themselves. They don't have to be hurting and dying by themselves. They can come get on the path with us. And I love this. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Yes, we are. Yes, we are. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. And that is very true. If you get active in trying to help other drunks, this will be your experience. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. And my experiences with trying to help, I've brought them home. I've detoxed them in my house. I've run a little halfway house in one of my bedrooms, just a rotating door of drunks. Our neighbors thought that drug dealers lived at my house because there was so much traffic coming and going. Isn't that great? Your neighbors think you're drug dealers, but you're doing AA. You're doing God's work. We had to explain to them what was going on. But in working with other people, not everybody wants to do what we do. Not everybody's ready to do what we do. We see some things of just heartbreaking cases, heartbreaking, like wanting sobriety for them so much, watching them die, watching them go to jail, watching them get committed, watching them go out and create havoc. We see all of that. And for me, what's happened, it used to tear me apart, and now it's more of a, it's just, and I don't think it's just a reality. You know, like we were talking about earlier, most of us don't make it. most alcoholics will die drunk. It's very few that make it. It is the minority in AA. So that's why I think it's so important too that we're carrying the message of AA, because we got a powerful message, powerful. And it's funny too. I mean, I have one gal running around naked out in my front yard. That was fun. Trying to rein her back in. She was coming off of heroin, and she just kind of lost it. And we found out later that she was taking benzos, too, that she hadn't been totally honest about her little stash of benzos, of Klonopin. So that's what created the run in the front yard. Nothing like a little benzo high to give you a great idea, you know? So, anyway, gotta love that Klonopin. Anyway, but there is a vast amount of fun about it all. And we do, we have a lot of fun in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, this is really where I learned how to play and laugh and joke and have a good time. You know, we put on talent shows, we do retreats, we just started a conference. We get together regularly to celebrate anniversaries. The women I sponsor, my sponsorship family, we get together once a month and have a good time. You know, we have the Bad Santa Christmas party, which you never know what kind of gifts are going to show up there. And I'll leave that open to the imagination. Just, you know, naughty females. You know what I mean? So that's always fun. Come home with new toys. we have a lot of fun. You know, we've lightened up. You know, it's serious stuff what we're talking about here. It's like there's a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seeming willingness and levity, but just underneath, there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. And that's my experience today. I like to have a lot of fun and act like a damn fool. But underneath that is that deadly earnestness. I know that this is about my life. And I know it's about yours, too. It's about your life, too. Does anybody have anything they want to share from their experience about what we've been talking about? Feel free. I'll bring the little mic to you. Anybody? Do y'all need to take a break? No? Keep going. I'm feeling a little restlessness in the room. Keep going? All right. There's a solution. I like what it says on the bottom of 17. Discovered a common solution. To me, it speaks of we're not different. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what you got, what you don't got. Same problem, same solution. Single problem, single solution. It keeps it easy. I used to get told all the time, a house divided can't stand. If you've just got alcoholism, you're in good shape. If that's what you're using to treat your malady. House divided can't stand. So common problem, common solution. Am I an alcoholic that they describe here? If I am, all my other isms will straighten out. All my other little issues and problems and disorders will straighten out. And not that other people don't have some other things that are serious. They do. But I'm a garden variety drunk, and I just had the normal crazy stuff that seemed really scary, but it just needed, once it was treated by the steps, it started to diminish. So common problem, common solution. I love what it talks about on 18, when it talks about the ex-problem drinker, great description of alcoholism or sponsorship. The ex-problem drinker who has found the solution, who's properly armed with facts about themselves. Am I properly armed with facts about myself? Am I clear on my drinking experience? You know, am I clear on my mental obsession, what that looked like? What my thinking was? What happened when I started drinking? Can I talk about that? Am I clear on that? Am I clear on my experience in recovery and through these steps? Because that's what I'm going to start talking to other drunks about. So I got to be properly armed with facts about myself. I can't, you know, because we can sniff a lie in a New York second. Or somebody that's full of poo. I mean, we can, and we automatically shut them off, or we start to play with them because we think it's entertaining. Well, that's what I do. So I need to be properly armed with facts about myself. Have I done what I needed to do so that that's in place? Who has found this solution, who's properly armed with facts about himself, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. And that's been my experience. People that I hear, something happens. One of the things I loved about Don was I heard him when he was talking. I heard him. The Desert Fathers, these ascetic monks that lived out in the desert and long, long, long time ago, they were called Abba. They'd call each other Abba this or myself. Yay! I like the sound of my own voice. So is everybody pretty comfortable with step one? Can we like mosey on down to step two and get on our knees and do step three? Mm-hmm. Do that together? Would y'all like to do that together? And get launched? Be the spearhead? Y'all read that in the book?
Yep.
Spearhead of God's ever-advancing creation. The ladies I sponsor love that. They go, be the spearhead. Everybody will do that. If it gets read in the meeting, they'll do it. It's kind of funny. It's kind of like an inside joke. So we're agnostics. I was absolutely an agnostic when we got here. Although I like to romance the idea that maybe I was an atheist when I was younger in my little rebellious stage. I used to wear upside down crosses and say that there was no God, and I had all the nice little arguments to prove it and liked to argue about it and prove my points and explain to you why there wasn't a God. And of course my favorite argument was, if there's a God, why is there war? If there is a God, why are there starving children? If there is a God, how could a God have anything to do with that? There is no God. It's just man. And those were my arguments on why there was no underlying power in this world. And, you know, when you become an alcoholic, crushed by this self-imposed crisis, I love the question they have. You got to fearlessly face the proposition that either there is or there isn't. What's your choice going to be? And I have, of course, chosen that there is. Because all my heroes in AA that I loved said there was. And they seemed to be demonstrating something a lot better was going on in their life than was going on in my life. They absolutely said that God made those things possible. And I identified, and I just laughed. I'd seen spiritual release, but I like to tell myself it wasn't true. Could happen for them, but not for me. This was the perfect description of me. I had codes and philosophies. I can treat AA as a code and philosophy, as a better way of life. And it's all up here. And if it never moves into my heart and how I live, then it's just knowledge. And knowledge, as we know, avails us nothing. And there's nothing worse than an alcoholic with a whole bunch of knowledge and no relationship with God. But they can talk to you about God that'll move you and move the mountain. But they don't believe it themselves. It's tragic. So, but this is me. You know, I try to will myself and will a spiritual life, will myself better, will myself to change, and I couldn't do it. I can't manage my, I wanted to manage my spiritual life, and I couldn't do it. I wanted to manufacture a spiritual life. I wanted to be somewhere other than where I was. And I didn't want to have to do all the things that they had done. I just wanted to be poofed. That's my favorite word, poofed. I just wanted to be poofed. I really did. So, but this is telling us you got to search fearlessly, and you'll find that. And they call it honest doubt and prejudice, and that helped me a lot. That it was okay that I had these honest doubts about God, and I had these old ideas that was okay too. And whatever I was aware of currently, that I could surrender that, because God knows down the line some more will show up that I'll have to disregard too. But I needed to start where I was at. And that's the case for me today too. Whenever I'm submitting myself to this process with an individual or in a group, it's the same thing. You know, I submit myself and whatever shows up. And something always does that I wasn't aware of before. Some of the ones that I had that were really, really got in the way is I really believed, and I talked about this last night, I really believed that God had favorites. I believed that in my core, that there were the haves and the have-nots, and I would always be a have-not. And that you had to be good for God, and that you had to do this spiritual life perfect, make no mistakes. You couldn't be human. With the women I sponsored for a long time, I would not, my life was not an open book to them. I had to be perfect. And it was like I was setting myself up on a pedestal for them. And that's what I did. And that's really dangerous, because then their reliance is upon me. And I'm helping to create that environment. Because when we're new and we're vulnerable and all that stuff, we don't know. We'll go and do anything. We'll believe anything, just about. And it can be really dangerous if I'm setting that up for people to get their reliance upon me, like I have an answer or I am the answer. If I'm, you know, and how that'd show up is, well, I'm threatened if they talk to somebody else. Or, you know, I've been telling them something for months and they go listen to some jackass in a meeting and say, guess what I heard? I'm like, I've been telling you that for months. What's going on here? You know? I hate when that happens. I want to be the one. And that's crazy talk. You know what I mean? But that's definitely a place that I have been with that. I digress. Anyway, sharing honest doubt and prejudice with this idea. And the word God brings up a particular idea of him with which someone had tried to impress them during childhood. I don't know if I got those old ideas growing up or if I just accumulated them on my own because it seemed convenient. I really don't know. But Don used to tell me all the time, you got some funky ideas about God. Funky. And you need to let those go. But this was me to a T. You know, and they talk about on 46, these were my arguments. I look upon this world of warring individuals, warring theological systems, you know, and all the wars that are fought in the name of God. You know, I mean, that was my favorite war cry. Inexplicable calamity with deep skepticism. We looked askance at many individuals who claimed to be godly. You know, I did all of that. The hypocrites in church. Organized religion, they're all a bunch of hypocrites. You know, I loved that stuff. How could a supreme being have anything to do with it at all? And yet, who could comprehend a supreme being anyhow? Yet in other moments we found ourselves thinking when enchanted by a starlit night, who then made all this? And I had those experiences. I'd be out in nature or different things, and I would be in this moment of awe and would wonder those things. So it's like, you know, both of those things going on. And they ask us to lay it aside, lay aside these old ideas, these prejudices. So I had to do that. I had to admit the possible existence of a creative intelligence, a spirit of the universe. And, you know, and the promises that are in there, that I will begin to be possessed of a new sense of power and direction, provided I take other simple steps. We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek him. And for a long time, I thought God made very hard terms. I thought the terms were very hard. But that it wasn't. I was just paying. No debt goes unpaid. Those were all consequences of actions that I was taking, and I thought God was doing it to me. It was a bitter pill that I swallowed when I realized through inventory that I created it out of my own distorted thinking and perceptions and fear and resentments and all that, that God did not do it to me. Bitter pill, but I had to swallow it. And that's where the freedom is anyway. I am the problem. So for a long time I thought that God made very hard terms. And I found that that's not true. That the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. And that's my job, to be an earnest seeker. It's open, we believe, to all men. You know, and they talk about, you know, that concept over and over again. And, you know, afterwards we find ourselves accepting many things which seemed entirely out of reach. Once I started to have experiences of trusting God and things working out beautifully, me staying out of the way and things happening that shouldn't be happening, you know, my faith started to grow and I understood what they were talking about, that we start to accept things that when I first got here seemed entirely out of reach. It doesn't make sense. I don't know how this stuff works. It's amazing. What happens to us and in our lives when we're just willing and we start showing up and trying to do this thing, however imperfectly. It doesn't make sense. The world of the Spirit doesn't make sense to the rational mind. So do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? Absolutely. Is everybody here willing to believe? Sweet! I like that word dubious, too. I had to look that up. I didn't know what it meant. It means questionable. I like this word revolutionary, too, in here. On page 50, that last paragraph, it says, here are thousands of men and women, worldly indeed. I don't know if I was worldly. I was kind of a puke, but... I like to think of myself like I was worldly. They flatly declare that since they've come to believe in a power greater than themselves, to take a certain attitude toward that power and to do certain simple things, there's been a revolutionary change in their way of living and thinking. In the face of collapse and despair, in the face of the total failure of their human resources, they found that a new power, peace, happiness, and sense of direction flowed into them. This happened soon after they wholeheartedly met a few simple requirements. Well, soon means like, that means like now to me. Soon happened to be, you know, months and years. But in terms of me understanding and having a real experience with this, for my whole life to get revolutionized. And that's what happened. My life got revolutionized. And I looked up that word, too, and I like the definition of that word. Revolutionized means if I'm going in this direction, I get picked up and set an entirely different direction. I am no longer going that way. I am going that way. And that's what happens to us here. Our life gets revolutionized. Our mind gets revolutionized. We were going down that road. Now we're going down that road. And it's that clear. It's that distinct. And this was me sober, 51, leaving aside the drink question. They tell why living was so unsatisfactory. They show how the change came over them when many hundreds of people are able to say that the consciousness of the presence of God today is the most important fact of their lives. They present a powerful reason why one should have faith. And that's what happened. I saw it happening in you before it ever happened in my life. I believed it because you said it worked. Even though I still had all the doubts in my mind and all the fear and thinking that I was different and you had some kind of special hold on God that I didn't have, there's a part of me that was willing to believe that you were right and that what this was saying was right. So I started taking actions that I wouldn't normally take and started becoming open-minded on things that I wasn't open-minded about before. Because I used to fight to the death on my beliefs, right or wrong. Even when I knew I was wrong, I'd keep fighting. That's crazy. That's nuts. So I believed because you believed, and because you talked about what you used to be like, and then I could see the person that you were today, and it was nothing like what you were describing. And you were saying that, well, I did this, and I got a relationship with my Creator, and things happened. Amazing things happened. So, well, if it could happen for you, if I'm not different, then it can happen for me. If the directions are the same for me that they are for you, then that this can happen for me too. And it was just like that. And of course, we love the bedevilments. Love the bedevilments. Page 52. And that's absolutely all about faith. You know, and they talk about the guy on the rocket ship. Yeah, you know, they hadn't done that yet, but I bet you they do it. And you know how they talk about, isn't a basic solution of these bedevilments more important than whether we should see newsreels of lunar flight? Of course it was. And then more important that I have a solution today with what's going on than how I know what it's going to look like in the future. I don't know anything anyway. But I think I do, but I don't. Bedevilments were a great description of me and have been me numerous times in sobriety. Either full on all of them or different parts of them. But I tell you, if you start being dishonest in one area of your life, it will quickly spread into every area. Being little Miss AA that I am, I'm going to try to keep it together while I'm still engaging in my dishonest activity. Nobody will know. You know, and then it starts showing up at work, starts showing up at home. I stop being effective with people I sponsor. I start showing up to my home group and I don't really care what's going on and I'm annoyed by all of them. I don't really want to participate anymore. It starts showing up everywhere. Every area of my life starts getting impacted by it. So it gets really uncomfortable. I didn't like it when it said self-imposed crisis and my alcoholism was a self-imposed crisis. I wanted that to be a special gift from somebody. I don't want to take responsibility for my alcoholism, that it was self-imposed. I did it to myself. I don't like that idea at all. It kills the victim idea. But that I couldn't postpone or evade it anymore. I couldn't put it off and I couldn't hide from it. And it's the spiritual question. Either you're going to get on the path or you're not. A lot of people try to walk a middle road. There is no middle road. The middle road does not exist. They say there is no middle of the road. And I'll hear it in meetings sometimes. People talk about middle of the road sobriety. I'm like, what middle? There is no middle of the road. Either you're actively living this way or you're not. It's one or the other.
Bob Olson once said about that, he said, I can't postpone it or evade it. I can't take a vacation from my alcoholism.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because you hear people say, I say, well, where have you been? Well, I was taking a little break from recovery.
Right.
I just got, you know, it's a little, I needed balance in my life.
I heard Keith Lewis talk about seeking balance once. We had about to do a retreat in Richmond, and he goes, yeah, what that really means is you're trying to get laid. I'm seeking balance. I thought that was right on. In my case, anyway. I'm seeking balance. I'm going to try to balance my life. And, you know, and that's a ridiculous thing. I am someone who has no power is going to try to balance my life. Like I have any idea of what I'm supposed to be doing and where I'm supposed to be doing, and I can make those kinds of decisions. Really. I don't balance my life at all. I don't try to balance it at all. My life is incredibly full. People look at my life and they say, how do you do everything that you do? I don't get it. You know, how do you have time for your family and AA? I sponsor a lot of people. I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous in my home group and carrying the message. I have a full-time job. I got a husband. I got a son. I got friends. I got a community that I live in. My life is incredibly full. Incredibly full. And people look at it and they're like, they don't know. And I don't do it. I absolutely rely on God's power to go do what I got to do. I don't try to do it at all. I'd never get out of bed. I can't do it. There's no way I can do what I do on my own. No way. It's absolutely God power. If somebody comes and asks me to sponsor them, if they're willing to meet the conditions that I put out there, I don't say no. And that's my personal belief. I don't believe we ever say no if they're willing to do what we do and they're an alcoholic. If they're ready to go, let's go. I don't ever say I'm too busy. I've got too much going on. I already sponsor too many women. That never comes out of my mouth. But that's also how I've been trained up in AA. When they talked about early in the book that strenuous work with other alcoholics was vital to permanent recovery, I believe that. I drank the Kool-Aid. I drank the AA Kool-Aid. I believe it. And so that's how I live. Because it's the only thing that's ever worked for me. If something else had worked, then I'd be doing something else. So I don't balance my life. I don't try to balance my life. I don't say no to a legitimate AA request, and it doesn't matter how inconvenient it is. Because my life is busy, though, I make it a priority, though, to make time for my family, because you can stay incredibly busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. And if you are someone who says yes, and they know you're going to say yes, you'll get asked to do a lot, which is a real gift in itself anyway. But solitude is important. Spending time with family is important. Being present for those things is really important. So I make time for that. And it's all God-directed. I go into prayer with my little calendar. Here it is, God. What are we going to do? And that's what I do. And it works. And I actually learned that from Bobbles. When he was talking about the 11th step. And I like what it says in here that it's a simple reliance. It's not complicated. When we saw others solve their problems by a simple reliance upon the Spirit of the universe, we had to stop doubting the power of God. And that was a specific direction to me. I felt like I had to stop doubting. And it was a conscious choice on my part. So the best that I could bring consciously to that question, or not question, that direction, that's what I did. And I consciously made a decision to stop doubting the power of God, to cut it out. And if any of that stinking thinking showed up, which it did, I just immediately started praying and asking God to remove it. So God either is or he isn't. What's our choice to be? And I love this. I love this. I love this. Oh, yeah. I was a worshiper. Worshiper of other things, other people, places. Sentiment. I love to worship the past. A sentimental fool. The way things used to be. Especially in that relationship. Can't we go back to the way things used to be? When it was good in the beginning? You know, instead of growing where I'm at currently, I want to go back to when it was easy and we're like bunnies. That was fun. That's what I want, because that's no work. You know, when it's fresh and new. You know what I mean? You know, the day after day commitment of showing up.